in that remote, unexplored last frontier on Earth. Unchanged since prehistoric times. The land unknown.
Hi folks, this is Cian. You're listening to the Lost Valley podcast and you're very welcome to the Explorers Club. Sit down, enjoy our fine furniture and our ambient surroundings. Observe all our maps up on the walls and get yourself something nice to drink. We do have some cream liqueur around here somewhere. Unfortunately, it is one of those supermarket knockoffs. Let's just hope it has an entertaining pun name based on a better known product. Yeah, this is the podcast about lost worlds in lore and literature, and this episode is all about a short story from 1926 called Through the Crater's Rim by the marvelous A. Hyatt Verrill, who we're going to be talking about. So yeah, as you're getting ready for that one, this is a kind of a 1920s pulp adventure, a kind of mid-period lost world fiction, and maybe not one of the more serious examples, and certainly not one of the earlier ones. We're not really getting into the heavy stuff or the originators of the genre. I'm still working my way up to that one. I'm just trying to get this show started off with a few kind of easy episodes, not exactly heavy hitters. But you know what? I think we'll find some interesting things even in these kind of mid-period examples of the genre. So before I get started, I will say you can say hi over at Instagram, where I am at Lost Valley Podcast, and over on Mastodon, where I'm still at White Atlantic Weird for historical reasons. And as always, over at buymeacoffee.com /now/ Lost Valley. I'm going to say thanks to a couple of people who did so recently. So I want to say thanks to John Oaken, who said, your exploration of pulp and lost world stories, an examination of the weird through those lenses, were some of my favorite parts of the last podcast. So I'm excited about the future of the Lost Valley in terms of Lost World cinema. And I have to recommend, in quotes, Planet of the Dinosaurs, an awful bizarre film that sees a bunch of 70s astronauts marooned on a planet that looks suspiciously like the deserts of LA County, only filled with dinosaurs. Yeah, I'm familiar with this one. This is a bit of a guilty pleasure. It's a terrible film in almost every regard, except it has bizarrely good stop motion animated dinosaurs, which is one of my favorite things in the world. And everything else about the film screams incredibly cheap. We went out into the desert outside Los Angeles and filmed some not very well-known actors. And so I think even the Vasquez Rocks show up in that one. Jeez, don't quote me on that, but you know, it has that kind of a look to it. It's that kind of Los Angeles desert you've seen in 100 cheap movies and old episodes of Star Trek. And sadly, Star Trek Picard in more recent years. So thanks to John Oaken for that one. And I also want to say thanks to Mike J, who writes, really enjoying the podcast. Very much appreciate your research and critical perspective. You're building up a substantial body of well-honed texts. It would be good to see them in print at some point. I love the way you use weird fiction, hence this episode, as a way into folklore and the occult, partly because that's how I first approached them. I've particularly enjoyed your Victorian Edwardian excursions, H.R. Haggard, Arthur Machen, Lafcadio Hearn, etc. Looking forward to more along these lines. And I've got to say that thanks to Ben Greenway for pointing out that Mike J is the author of a book called The Heirloom Gang, which I have to say, folks, looks absolutely tremendous. I'm going to get my hands on a copy of this. This is about a sort of a Victorian conspiracy theory. It looks to be about the nature of belief and paranoia in Victorian times. So very interested in that. And as always, I'm always kind of slightly alarmed to find out that people who are listening are actually very creative or accomplished. It makes me hope that I'm doing better. Let's just put it that way. Your Dino Synth album recommendation for this episode is called Time of the Titans by the artist known as Thagomizer. That name, of course, comes from Gary Larson cartoons, the guy who wrote The Far Side. And in his cartoons, a bunch of cavemen call the back spiky end of a stegosaurus. They called it a Thagomizer in honor of the late Thag, who met his end at that end of the dinosaur. So this album, Time of the Titans, is not nice, friendly, easygoing dino synth. This is edgy, unsettling dino synth that makes you feel like you're being, as the name of one of the tracks is, stalked by the terrible claw. That is a reference to the dinosaur Deinonychus. But my standout track for this album is called Refugium, and definitely worth a listen. So, right, we'll move on. So hopefully you're sitting comfortably, sipping on something nice. And we're going to talk about a man by the name of Alpheus Hyatt Verrill. So this fellow, well, he was many things. So according to Wikipedia, he was an American zoologist, an explorer, an author. So he's known for writing books about travel and about biology. And he wrote a lot of pulp fiction as well in the 1920s and 30s. So he did a lot of exploring himself. He tracked down some odd stuff while he was exploring and wrote about it in ways which are very reminiscent of Lost World fiction. And I think and he wrote some genuine Lost World fiction as well, as we're going to hear. And so I think with this fellow in particular, and maybe this is why I find him interesting, the veneer between fact and fiction, the veil, I should say, between fact and fiction is thin. And one of the themes I'm going to be returning to in this series, I think, is going to be how Lost World out and out fiction got turned into fact, and back again the other way as well, as two sort of subgenres feeding off one another. So Hyatt Verrill was well known for going on explorations around the world and writing books about it. So there's a vast list of his work here, and it includes stuff like The Book of the West Indies. This is him writing as far back as 1917. Cuba, Past and Present. That's from 1928. Jamaica of Today. Lost Treasure, True Tales of Hidden Hoards. My Jungle Trails in 1937. So, yeah, he spent several decades going around the world and writing fiction. And I think in a later episode, we are going to get more into an occasion when he believed that he had found what was known as a lost white tribe, or lost Indians, as they were called. This was the persistent idea that European explorers had, that there were groups of anomalously white people living in tropical parts of the world, in various different locations, to be fair. And so I think we'll have an episode about that coming up. But already in the can, I have an episode with Michael Robinson, the author of the book, The Lost White Tribe. I'm going to kind of building up to that with some of this Hyatt Verrill material. So hopefully we'll get there. So this is a guy who not only wrote fictional stories about, you know, lost worlds, but he sort of believed that he had found one himself, or at least a lost race, because he believed that he had found a lost race of like mysterious white Indians. And we'll get into a little bit about what exactly he might have really found, as opposed to what he believed it was, a little bit later. So if you look this guy up now, most of what you'll find is the work he did for Amazing Stories. So this is obviously one of the most famous and the earliest of the science fiction pulp magazines, starting in 1926, published by the great Hugo Gernsback. A lot of these magazines haunted me when I was younger. The covers, usually by an artist by the name of Frank R. Paul, the absolutely legendary Frank R. Paul. Some of these are just so stirring. Paul tended to create these larger-than-life creatures and monsters and aliens, you know, very, really out there, quite different to anything you'd see today. You know, this is decades before the dominance of the alien grey, you know, back when bug-eyed monsters were still bug-eyed monsters. And whenever an astronaut on the cover of Amazing Stories landed on some strange planet, you could be sure that he was, about to shake hands with or have a shootout with some kind of giant copepod or a Martian biped with ridiculously overinflated lungs and a tiny face or something bananas like that. And the other thing Frank R. Paul did, he always used these kind of flat tonal backgrounds, like the sky would always be a lurid yellow or red. That was very common in his work. And I, you know, not being able to get a hold of these magazines in particular, but I think when I was in secondary school, I came across, in the art school in Cork, the art college, I came across a copy of a book about the history of science fiction art, and there were loads of pages of these Amazing Stories covers, and I was utterly fascinated by them. Not only that, but Frank R. Paul was known for like amazing interior black and white artwork as well, which is astonishing and stirring in a completely different way. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about the December 1926 issue of Amazing Stories. So that's the, you know, within the first year of its getting started. We've got Hyatt Verrill writing a story called Through the Crater's Rim. And the opening image here in black and white, glorious black and white, I presume by Frank R. Paul, it looks like his style. We have two explorers, one of them in your classic khaki shorts and pith helmet. He's wielding a machete as he goes through a jungle, and he's surrounded by these tentacles that are dripping from trees above his head. Not only that, but one of these trees has captured his companion in its tentacles. So that tips us off that this story is going to have that old trope of the carnivorous plants, which I love. And the two men appear to be coming through this grove of these carnivorous trees, and behind them is maybe a cleft in a valley, I think it's supposed to be. And again, we're getting serious kind of Lost World vibes off this. And I love when in Lost World fiction, when the explorers have to come through some dramatic entryway, some sort of gateway between the real world and the Lost World. I love that. And so that theme is very strong in Through the Crater's Rim. So it's 1926, and the story starts off with a little note, presumably from the editor. Maybe this is presumably the great Hugo Gernsback himself writing. In this story, the author of Beyond the Pole, which is another Lost World Hyatt Verrill story, the author gives us another one of his amazing contributions to science fiction. So you've probably heard this one. That's an early term that I don't know that Hugo Gernsback invented this, but he certainly tried to popularize it as a name for what he was calling, because by the mid-20s, the term science fiction still had not been agreed upon as a description for this type of material. Here we find a strange race living within an extinct volcanic crater somewhere in Central America. When it is remembered that only a few years ago, an entirely new race was discovered by scientists in Panama, which are now known better under the name of White Indians, it should be understood that Mr. Verrill is not taxing your credulity by the strange race which he pictures in this story. We promise you a good half hour's reading in this well-told tale. Now, so Gernsback, or whoever has written this editorial, is making reference to something which had happened just a few years earlier and which was quite well known. And in fact, it's interesting to me to find out exactly how well known this must have been, because it's fairly an obscure case right now. I'm just doing a quick search. There was a fellow called Richard Oglesby Marsh. I think it was 1925. So yeah, shortly before this, he like Hyatt Verrill had a story like this personally, which was not as well known. But Richard Marsh's better known story is about finding what he believed to be a tribe of white Indians, quote unquote, in Panama. And he actually brought, I think, three of them back to the US. He brought two young teenagers and an elder. And there was some, you know, various experts in linguistics and in ethnology and anthropology investigated these folks, and nearly all came to the conclusion that they were people with albino, or people with what's the correct term for that? They were albinos, I suppose. There lingered a bit of mystery as to their language, because there were some linguists who had more exotic explanations for the exact language that they spoke, and there was this idea that, oh, you could trace similarities between the way they spoke and the language of various European nations. So the idea that, well, maybe they were descended from, you know, conquistadors who went native hundreds of years ago, which of course was a very exciting explanation to Americans back in the 1920s. They thought they would have been very interested in that. They were far more interested in that than, you know, learning anything about actual indigenous culture frequently. But by and large, it's accepted that they were albinos. Now, interesting to read that by the time this story is being published, you know, it's still Hugo Gernsback is here presenting this as if, yep, they were just white Indians. That's just what they were. And Hugo Gernsback, you know, by and large at this time was doing his best to publish what we might call, Jeez, I don't want to go too far with this. I was about to say he was interested in hard science fiction, but I've been reading a few of these 1920s amazing stories, and there's some fairly wacky stuff in it. So hard science fiction might be a step too far, but he was interested in real science, and he thought that this kind of fiction was a way to educate people on real science and astronomy and things like that. So interesting how he's presenting that particular story. So anyway, the tale begins. It's in Panama. We have three Europeans or Americans, probably. We have Hazen, Lieutenant Hazen, a fellow called Fenton, and one other fellow. Don't see his name just here, but they're sitting on the veranda of the Hotel Washington in Cologne. And one of them is an aviator, and he's just taken a flight over the jungles of Darien Province. So Darien Province is down at the bottom of Panama, or Panama meets Colombia. To this day, it's like, I think it's the only gap in the Pan American Highway. It goes all the way, all the way down down through North America, all the way down through Central America, and all the way down through South America, except for this kind of 100-mile patch of jungle down at the bottom of Panama. Now, there's various reasons why that section was never completed. I believe the Colombian government to this day doesn't really, or the Panamanian government rather, doesn't want easy access to a border with Colombia for various reasons. But it was a region of kind of intrigue and mystery, and it shows up sometimes in pulp stories because it had this, even, I mean, I worked in Panama about 10 years ago for a few months, and you still hear stories that, oh, it's this famous place where backpackers, try and make their way through the jungle, and they end up getting robbed, or they get lost, or they die in some terrible way. So it's an area that has a bit of a mystique about it, even to this day. So yeah, if it's 1926 and you're talking about Panama, which is not a huge country, yeah, sensible place to place your lost city. So this airman has seen something from the air. He thinks it's a lost city. They make a plan that the other two guys are going to go in by foot, and in a week's time, because I think he can't get off work basically, the airman is going to fly over the jungle and land on the city and meet up with them, and then they'll all be heroes, presumably. So the two lads are hiking through the jungle, and they come to a place. Now, this is a relatively short story, so things happen fairly fast. They get to a place where, let me see now. I'll read a little bit. With bulging, rolling eyes, blanched face, and ghastly, terror-stricken features, he was struggling, fighting madly with a writhing, coiling, grey object, which I took for a gigantic snake. Already his body and legs were bound and helpless in the coils. With his machete, he was raining blows upon the quivering, awful thing, which slowly, menacingly wavered back and forth before him, striving to throw another coil about his body. And then, as I drew near, my senses reeled. I felt that I was in some awful nightmare. The object, so surely, relentlessly, silently encircling and crushing him, was no serpent, but a huge liana drooping from the lofty branches of a great tree. It seemed absolutely incredible, impossible, unbelievable. But even as I gazed, transfixed with horror, paralyzed by the sight, the vine threw its last coil about the dying man, and before my eyes drew the quivering body into the trees above. So there you have it. This last land that they're about to enter is guarded by a forest of carnivorous trees. By the 1920s, this is already something of an old adventure story trope, going back to at least the 1870s and the supposed man-eating tree of Madagascar, which is a famous hoax from that era. But yeah, shows up quite often in stories of this kind. But I quite like this one. I like the fact that the Lost World is guarded by a whole forest of these things. So our protagonist has to fight his way through the trees, and he comes to a cliff face with a cleft inside it, and he climbs up, and he sees a person in the gap in the rock, and this person is an odd-looking individual. Hyatt Verrill writes, "I have said he was a man. But even in that brief second that I glimpsed him, before I bowled him over, I realized that he was unlike any man I or anyone else had ever seen. Barely 3 feet in height, squat, with enormous head and shoulders. He stood shakily upon the tiniest of bandy legs and half supported his weight by his enormously long, muscular arms. Had it not been that he was partly clothed and that his face was hairless, I should have thought him an ape. And now, as I picked myself up and stared at him, my jaw gaped in utter amazement. The fellow was running away from me at top speed upon his hands, his feet waving and swaying in the air. So, as our man comes into the kind of comes into the open from this dark defile, to quote, I think Kipling, he finds a lost city of these people who walk on their hands with their legs up in the air. It's implied that they are like vaguely ape-like, but more or less human. He sees elements of their culture, which makes him think of the Aztecs and other great peoples from the history of Latin America. Or Central and South America, I should say. We never get too much information about who they actually are, or where they come from, or what they're, you know, how closely related are they to, you know, your regular Homo sapien? Are they a type of Homo sapien, or are they something else? He's kind of mixing and mashing his metaphors here, and he never really gets time to explain himself. And you know, the pulp style of writing, as you can probably tell, is sensationalist, it's fast, it's about action, and pulp characters famously don't have much time for pontificating or for even for explaining what's going on sometimes. But I will say one thing, I dislike when a Lost World story turns into a kind of a parable, like when characters go to a Lost World and they discover that, you know, everything is backwards there compared to where they're from, because, and this kind of ruined, what's that book, Message in a Copper Cylinder, which is a very fairly old example of the genre. It's from the, I think it's from the 1870s, and it has one of the earliest, you know, dinosaurs in fiction. Surely, you know, proper dinosaurs, not counting like Jules Verne's, you know, aquatic plesiosaur and ichthyosaur from, of course, Journey to the Center of the Earth. But in that story, you know, it turns out that the last race of people under the ground, you know, they hate light and they love darkness. They worship death and they hate life. And you're going into a different place with that. You're going into the Jonathan Swift tradition, where the places the character goes to, they're not supposed to be real. They're not supposed to be convincing. They're just a satire of, you know, the writer's own culture. And I find that less interesting. These stories work best for me when there's some level of credibility, even if they're obviously unbelievable. I want during the time I'm reading the story, I want to believe that the explorer actually did this. I want to live in a world where, you know, in 1926, it was still possible to believe you could go out into the jungle and find something like this. And that kind of Swiftian, you know, hint at the fact that these beings walk upside down, it's a little bit topsy-turvy for me, a little bit, you know, or what's that story, the Gulliver of Mars? I don't know if anyone's ever read that one, where it's kind of like proto Edgar Rice Burroughs kind of stuff from the I think the 1890s or maybe 1902 or something like that. But this character goes to Mars and he finds this group of two groups of feuding people, and they're called the Hither people and the Thither people. So, you know, hither and thither, it's like too cutesy almost. But fortunately, High Feral doesn't really run with this theme. It does not turn out that this race that he finds living inside in what turns out to be the rim of an extinct volcano, they're not actually some sort of a spoof of his own society. They are just very much their own thing. What do we find out about them? In some ways, he finds that they are very primitive. In other ways, they're quite sophisticated. They have an aqueduct. They have stone buildings. There's a hint that they didn't build them. Now, this is a trope that's very common. It goes right back to H. Rider Haggard. You know, the idea of the semi-savage race squatting in the ruins of something built by a greater ancient race. That's very common. You know, and that's right from King Solomon's Mines, and it's always hinted that the lost cities Alan Quatermain finds are the people he meets, the tribes he meets are not the ones who built the great structures. And the hint always, though Haggard was sometimes not overt about this, but the hint is that someone else built this and that someone else was Roman or Mediterranean or basically European. Quite a common motif in these stories. But Hyatt Ferrell doesn't really go there. He seems happy enough to believe that this group of people are somehow, if not descended from, then at least influenced by, known South American cultures. So that's a positive, I suppose. He meets their king. He impresses them with another old trope, which is he pulls out a pipe and starts smoking, and they're shocked by this because they've never seen it before. Again, the white explorer who does something ordinary and then accidentally, makes everybody worship him and think that he's a god. That goes right back to King Solomon's minds as well. So we're trafficking in well trafficked territory here. Incidentally, before this, I should have said, when our main character is running through the jungle, he's constantly talking about being worried about a tribe called the Kuna, and he talks about them as if they're ferocious and scary. And I did see a lot of Kuna people in my time in Panama. There's still a group that lives there. They're associated with, to some degree, they found a place, I suppose, in the Panamanian economy with regards to tourism, because some of their arts are very popular. Some of their textiles are bright, attractive, and it's, I suppose, a way that they found to make money. They also have a good amount of control over certain areas where they live, which allows them to have a bit of control over the manner in which the tourist industry operates. So that's a good thing. So it's just interesting to see how Hyatt Ferrell in the 20s is talking about them as if they're scary and they're going to chase you with pointed sticks. One thing I will say about the Kuna is that they seem to have a higher than average instance of albinism, and that this might be the root of some of the stories that circulated in relation to Panama and supposed white Indian tribes back in the 1920s. So that's interesting as well. So our main man is kind of strolling around this lost city. He's investigating the aqueduct. He's impressing the locals with his pipe smoking, and he's worried constantly that he's going to run out of matches and they will no longer be interested. Now, they also have a pyramid with a flat top in their city, and he figures that this obviously means that there's going to be a sacrifice once in a while, in the way of ancient South and Central American peoples. But this eventually does come to pass. He wakes up one day and he's run out of matches, and the king and his men have tied him up, and they're putting him onto the top of the pyramid. And there comes a point where he's almost about to get the chop when he hears a noise in the sky. And wouldn't you know it, his old mate from the hotel, what was it called, the Hotel Columbus? Hang on, I have to go back here. Almost, it was the Hotel Washington back in Cologne. He finds out that his mate in the aeroplane has appeared, and there's a bit of a fight and a scuffle when he lands, and they fight off a huge mass of these people. There's a rather gross bit when they plow the aeroplane into a bunch of the lost race and chop them up with the propellers, which is gross. And then the main character throws something out of the aeroplane in order to, so they can lose a bit of weight to take off. And this is it feels like a rather modern action movie kind of a sequence. They're being chased by all these people. It's a bit like Indiana Jones in his first film. The tribe is after them. You know, they need to get the aeroplane up into the sky. They're throwing stuff out of it. Your man throws what he thinks is a bottle, but it's actually a bomb. And he accidentally blows up the aqueduct and floods the whole city. And so you get the kind of classic trope of, we were the last people to see this place and now it's gone forever. Not only does it destroy the city, but it also wipes out all of the carnivorous trees that exist in the forest around it. And next month, it says, The Man Who Could Vanish, also by A. Hyatt Ferrell. This is without a doubt the best story on man-made invisibility that has ever been presented. Suppose we could suddenly make ourselves totally invisible. What would happen? And how could it be accomplished? Ferrell, or Hyatt Ferrell, I suppose, is his proper surname, also wrote a story which is kind of like a proto-zombie story. He did some interesting things in his life, but I think that's something that we are going to have to come back to another time. All right. I think I'm going to do some wrap-up stuff. This is going to be a fairly shortish episode. I want to say a few comments on the last episode about Thunder, the comic. Thunder, the King of the Congo, Frank Frazetta's comic from the 1950s. On Instagram, the follower known as XOOFXOS, it kind of gives me some information about the plane that Thunder flies. He says it's actually a C-47 Skytrain, a type of all-purpose cargo plane which is bizarrely still in use today. So thank you, I did not know that. On the last episode, I said Thunder, after the first episode that Frazetta wrote, the story became like he's no longer in the Lost Land, he's in the regular African jungle, even though he does face off against some weird stuff. I've read the rest of them now. There's only about six issues. And he meets such weird stuff. He meets another dinosaur, like a kind of a fake, a badly drawn T-Rex, because Frazetta is no longer doing the illustrations. He meets a lost city of like Amazon women, and he finds a lost race of these sort of fish people, or maybe amphibian people who worship the fake Tyrannosaurus. So, geez, all I can say is, the quote unquote regular African jungle that he has adventures in is so bizarre already that he might as well be in the Lost Land. And I'll go further than that, and I'll say that like Africa in the popular imagination of, pulp writers and comic writers in the 50s might as well have been the Lost World, because they tend to place all this mad stuff in it, even though it's not a fictional place, it's a real place. So I thought that was worth mentioning. What am I reading? I'm reading the same stuff I was reading the last time we talked. So I'm going to talk about some films I watched this week instead. I watched 1961's Mysterious Island. This is, of course, the semi sequel to Jules Verne's book, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. It's something of a classic. I'm sure most of you out there have seen this at some point. It was a bit of a perennial Sunday afternoon staple when I was growing up on Irish television. Always seemed to be on a Sunday afternoon. And it's, of course, a Ray Harryhausen film with Ray Harryhausen animated creatures in it. And it was directed by Cy Enfield, who also directed Zulu. I was a bit surprised to see that coming back to this. And yeah, it's a version of Jules Verne's book, and it's a sort of sequel to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. It's probably made with the 1950s Disney version of that previous film in mind, but it's not made by Disney, so it's not like an official sequel in any way. Captain Nemo does show up in both of them. Interestingly, going back to the Jules Verne books, the chronology makes no sense. It's supposed to be a sequel to 20,000 Leagues, but if you look at the dates cited, it's kind of 1860s, 1870s, and they're all wrong. They don't make sense. It doesn't make sense that Mysterious Island is happening after 20,000 Leagues, but there you go. That somehow they are. So what did I think coming back to this film? I didn't really have enough to say about it to make up a whole episode, but it's good fun. The creature effects aren't as common as I remembered. Like there's not that many creatures in it, but they're memorable. I've always remembered the giant crab, the giant terror bird, and especially the giant bees. I love that scene with the bees and the honeycomb. Very memorable stuff. Always enjoy a bit of Ray Harryhausen. I have to say, by comparison with Willis O'Brien, his mentor, and King Kong, Ray Harryhausen, this might be heresy, but I feel like his films, though the effects are great, the films around them are often quite weak. He never really found one great story, one great character, to showcase his effects as effectively as Willis O'Brien did in King Kong. You could argue that, well, I argue that Willis O'Brien really spent the rest of his career trying to chase that high and trying to replicate his ideas to often diminishing returns, and sometimes the kind of lack of interest from the Hollywood system around him, despite his early success. But those are all stories for another time. Yeah, always worth going back to Mysterious Island. There's some great matte paintings in it that establish the world of the Mysterious Island, and there's some great Lost World imagery through those matte paintings. They are sparingly used, but they're wonderful when they appear. My personal favorite is a scene when they're entering the interior of the island and they walk across a log bridge, and there's a wonderful matte shot, matte painting, which which is clearly supposed to be an homage to crossing the log scene in King Kong. If Ray Harryhausen didn't paint this himself, he certainly, I would be nearly certainly at a hand in designing the image of it, or maybe doing some preliminary drawings for it, because he really spent a whole lot of his career doing homages to King Kong and to Willis O'Brien. So yeah, what else did I watch recently? In this vein, a recent film, last couple of years, called The Edge of the World. This is about Raja James Brooke, the White Raja of Sarawak. He was an English guy who in real life went off to Sarawak and Borneo in the 1840s, and through kind of bluff and swagger, managed to carve himself out an unofficial bit of the British Empire, a kingdom of his own that was unacknowledged by the British government for a very long time, and before eventually being taken in as part of the empire more officially. And this film, though it looks great, and it's got, it's filmed in the real locations in Borneo, it looks fantastic. There's some good artistry being used here, but the script is kind of slow, the acting is kind of wooden, and there's something weird and old-fashioned about it in treating a guy like James Brooke as unambiguously a hero. I feel like we're very late in the day to be telling stories like this without nuance, and the whole thing is kind of naive, the way that like a Victorian novel from the 1840s itself might be, and I don't mean that in a good way, because I can enjoy that sort of thing, and I can put my anti-imperialism aside to enjoy a good old-fashioned adventure story. But in this day and age, I think you need to be bringing a bit of an angle to it, and to showcase there's some tropes here that are very old and a bit rubbish, like the white guy showing up in the exotic place and just instantly being better at everything than the locals. He's better at being one of them than they are, he's better at living their lifestyle, he's better at ruling their country than they are. I think we've grown up beyond that now, you know. It's the old Last Samurai stuff, it's the Last of the Mohicans, all that stuff. So definitely potential for this story to be told in an interesting way, but this story is kind of flat and naive with it, so I didn't really enjoy it all that much. Okay, I am getting ready to wrap up. I think there'll be a little bit more Hyatt Verrill in your future. I'm starting to wonder if I'm incorrect about assuming that his last name is Hyatt Verrill. I think Hyatt is probably his middle name, because he seems to have gone by just Hyatt Verrill, using Hyatt as a first name, Verrill as a last name. Just, that's what I'm leaning towards now after having spoken about him for a while. He also had a book called The Trail of the White Indians, which he wrote in 1920. And this is a wholly fictitious kind of a boy's adventure story about young fellows in the jungle tracking down a lost white race. So it's just to show you that how widespread this idea was. And like I said, you've got more of this fellow in your listening future, and we're going to be reading a little bit from that book and a little bit about Hyatt Verrill's own supposed discovery of a lost white race. So some stuff to look forward to there. So I think we'll wrap up there. So thanks for listening as always. Enjoy, take a last drink, and grab some books or a map or something of interest to keep you thinking about adventure stories on your way out. And so I'll thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.